Leona was vain about her looks until the day she died. One time she read an article in the McCall's magazine that said anger and hate could cause wrinkles. She was always threatening Iggy she was going to kill her, but she kept a smile on her face while she was doing it. Of course, Leona did get the richest husband, and her wedding was exquisite. She had been so scared that Iggy was going to ruin her wedding, but she needn't have been, because Iggy spent most of the day with the groom's family and charmed them so that by the end of the day they thought she was the grandest thing on bush or tree. Even at that age she had that Threadgood charm, and nobody in the world had charm like Buddy Threadgood. Mrs. Threadgood stopped for a moment to take a sip from her cup and reflected. "You know, this little coconut cake reminds me of the picnic, that awful day. I was already engaged to Cleo, so I must have been 17 at the time. It was a Saturday afternoon in June, and we had just had the best time at our BYO church picnic. The young people's group from the Andalusia Baptist Church had ridden the train over for the day, and Mama and Sipsy had baked about 10 coconut cakes for the occasion. The boys were wearing their white summer suits, and Cleo had just gotten himself a brand new straw hat from Papa's store. But for some reason, Buddy had talked Cleo into letting him wear his new hat on that day. After the picnic, Esiru and I came home with the cake plates, and all the Threadgood boys went down to the train station to see the group from Andalusia off, like they always did. Mama was out in the backyard with a pan picking figs off her tree, and I was out there with her when it happened. We heard the train start up, and just as it pulled out, the whistle blew. Then we heard the train screech and grind to a halt, and at the same moment we heard the girls screaming. I looked at Mama, who all of a sudden clutched at her heart, and fell down on her knees and cried out, "Oh, no, not one of my babies! Dear God, not one of my babies!" Papa Threadgood had heard the noise from the store and ran over to the station. I was on the front porch with Mama when the men came up the walk. The minute I saw that straw hat Edward was carrying, I knew it was Buddy. He had been flirting around with that pretty Marie Miller that day, and as the train pulled away, he'd stepped on the track, tipped his hat, and flashed his lady's smile at her just as the whistle blew. They say he never even heard the train that was coming up behind him. Oh, how I wish to this day Cleo had never lent him that straw hat. She shook her head. You just don't know. It like to have killed us all. But the one that took it the hardest was Iggy. She must have been 12 or 13 at the time, and had been over in Troutville playing ball when it happened. Cleo had to go over and get her. You never saw anybody hurt so much. I thought she would die right along with him. It would break your heart to look at her. She ran away the day of the funeral, just couldn't stand it. And when she did come home, all she did was go upstairs and sit in Buddy's room for hours on end, just sit up there in the dark. And when she couldn't bear to be home any longer, she'd just take off and go stay with Sipsy over in Troutville. But she never did cry. She was too hurt to cry. You know, a heart can be broken, but it keeps on beating just the same. Mama Threadgood was worried sick over her, but Papa said to let her go and do what she had to do. Course she was never the same after that. Not until she met Ruth. Then she started getting back to her old self. But I know she never really got over Buddy. None of us did. But I don't want to dwell on sad times. That wouldn't be right. Besides, Just like Itchy meeting Ruth, God never shuts a door unless he opens another. And I believe he must have sent Ruth over to stay with us that summer for a reason. His eye is on the sparrow, so I know he watches me. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, December 1st, 1931. Radio star in Whistle Stop. Hollywood has nothing on us. Our own Essie Rue Limeway, who is the organist for the Baptist Church and the accompanist for the Jolly Bell Ladies Barbershop Quartet, can be heard every morning at 6:30 this month on King Biscuit Time on WAPI Radio, playing the piano on a commercial that she made for the Stanley Charles Organ and Piano Company. When Mr. Charles says, "Remember, folks, I'll hold your organ or piano till Christmas," that's Essie Rue playing Jingle Bells in the background. So be sure and listen. Essie told me that Stanley Charles has entirely too many organs and pianos in stock this year and needs to sell them in a hurry. Essie says if you go in and mention her name, that he will give you a discount. The store is located in downtown Birmingham, right at the streetcar stop across from Gus's Hot Dogs. By the way, the O fell off Opal's beauty shop sign and just missed hitting Biddy Louise Otis in the head. Opal says she is glad that she wasn't hurt, but wasn't it a coincidence that Mrs. Otis's name started with an O, too? Julian says he is fixing it sometime this week, but Biddy says she is going in the back door from now on. Dot Weems. P.S. Opal says she's just got in a consignment of human hair ringlets. So if you have any place that needs a little more hair, she says to come on in. 212 Rhodes Circle, Birmingham, Alabama. January 5th, 1986. Evelyn Couch had locked herself in her sewing room and was eating a second pint of Baskin-Robbins chocolate chip ice cream and staring at the table, piled high with the Butterick sewing patterns she had not touched since the day she had bought them in a fit of good intentions. Ed was in his den, busy watching his football game, and that was fine with her, because lately he always looked at her whenever she had anything fattening to eat, and said in mock surprise, "Is that on your diet?" She had lied to the boy at Baskin-Robbins. She told him the ice cream was for a party for her grandchildren. She didn't even have grandchildren. Evelyn was 48 years old, and she had gotten lost somewhere along the way. Things had changed so fast. While she had been raising the required 2 children, a boy for him and a girl for me, the world had become a different place, a place she didn't know at all. She didn't get the jokes anymore. They all seemed so mean. And she was still shocked at the language. Here she was at her age, and she'd never said the F word. So she mostly watched old movies and reruns of the Lucy Show. When the Vietnam War was going on, she'd believed what Ed had told her, that it was a good and necessary war, and that anyone against it was a communist. But then, much later, when she finally decided that it may not have been such a good war, Jane Fonda had already moved on to her exercise class, and nobody cared what Evelyn thought anyway. She still held a grudge against Jane Fonda, and wished she'd get off TV and stop slinging her skinny legs around all the time. Not that Evelyn hadn't tried along the way. She had tried to raise her son to be sensitive, but Ed had scared her so bad, telling her that he would turn out to be a queer, she had backed off and lost contact with him. Even now her son seemed like a stranger to her. Both her children had passed her by. Her daughter Janice had known more about sex at 15 than Evelyn did at this very minute. Something had gone wrong. When she was in high school, things had been so simple. There were the good girls and the bad girls, and everyone knew who was who. You were either a member of the in-group or you were not. Evelyn had been in the Golden Circle, a cheerleader. She had not known the name of one person who was in the high school band, or the boys in the pegged pants and their girlfriends with the nylon see-through blouses and ankle bracelets. Her crowd had been the crew-cut, button-down madras shirt and pressed khakis for boys, and ship-and-shore blouses with circle pins for girls set. She and her girlfriends smoked one Kent cigarette at their sorority meetings, and at a pajama party they maybe had a beer, but that was it. No petting below the neck. Later, she had felt like a fool going with her daughter to get her fitted for a diaphragm. Evelyn had waited until her wedding night. And what a shock! Nobody had told her how much it would hurt. She still didn't enjoy sex. Every time she would start to relax, the bad girl image would pop into her head. She had been a good girl, had always acted like a lady, never raised her voice, always deferred to everybody and everything. She had assumed that somewhere down the line there would be a reward for that, a prize. But when her daughter had asked her if she'd ever had sex with anyone but her husband, and she'd answered, "No, of course not," her daughter's reply had been, "Oh, Mother, how dumb! You don't even know if he's any good or not. How awful!" It was true. She didn't know. So in the long run, it didn't matter at all if you had been good or not. The girls in high school who had gone all the way had not wound up living in back alleys in shame and disgrace like she thought they would. They wound up happily or unhappily married just like the rest of them. So all that struggle to stay pure, the fear of being touched, the fear of driving a boy mad with passion by any gesture, and the ultimate fear, getting pregnant, all that wasted energy was for nothing. Now movie stars were having children out of wedlock by the carload and naming them names like Moonbeam or Sunfeather. And what was the reward for staying sober? She had always heard, "There's nothing worse than a woman drunk," and she never allowed herself more than one whiskey sour. Now all the best people were waltzing into the Betty Ford Center getting their pictures made and having lots of parties thrown for them when they came out. She often wondered if Betty would take people who needed to lose 25 pounds. Her daughter had given her a puff of a marijuana cigarette once, but after all the hot pads on the counter started walking toward her, she got scared and never tried it again. So dope was out. Evelyn wondered where her group was, the place where she fit in. About 10 years ago, when Ed had started seeing a woman he worked with down at the insurance company, she had attended a group called The Complete Woman to try and save her marriage. She wasn't sure she loved Ed all that much, but she loved him just enough to not want to lose him. Besides, what would she do? She had lived with him as long as she had lived with her parents. The organization believed that women could find complete happiness if they, in turn, would dedicate their entire lives to just making their man happy. Their leader had informed them that all the rich and successful career women out there who appeared to be so happy were in reality terribly lonely and miserable and secretly envied them their happy Christian homes. It was a stretch to imagine that Barbara Walters might want to give it all up for Ed Couch, but Evelyn tried her hardest. Of course, even though she was not religious, it was a comfort to know that the Bible backed her up in being a doormat. Hadn't the Apostle St. Paul said for women not to usurp power over the men, but to be in silence? So, hoping she was on the right track, She started up the ladder on the 10 steps to complete happiness. She tried step number 1 and met Ed at the front door, nude, wrapped in saran wrap. But Ed had been horrified. He jumped inside the house and slammed the door. "Jesus Christ, Evelyn, what if I had been the paper boy? Have you gone insane?" So she never tried step number 2, going to his office dressed as a prostitute. But pretty soon the group leader, Nadine Fingerhut, got a divorce and had to go to work, so the group just sort of fizzled out. Then, after a while, Ed stopped seeing that woman, and things settled down. Later on, still looking, she had tried to get involved with the Women's Community Center. She liked what they stood for, but secretly wished they would wear just a little lipstick and shave their legs. She had been the only one in the room in full makeup, wearing pantyhose and earrings. She had wanted to belong, but when the woman suggested that next week they bring a mirror so they could all study their vaginas, she never went back. Ed said that those women were nothing but a bunch of frustrated old maids and too ugly to get a man anyway. So there she was, too bored for Tupperware parties and too scared to look at her own vagina. The night she and Ed went to their 30th high school reunion, she had been hoping she'd find someone to talk to about what she was feeling. But all the other women there were just as confused as she was and held on to their husbands and their drinks to keep themselves from disappearing. Their generation seemed to be on a fence, not knowing which way to jump. After the reunion, she would sit for hours looking at all her high school pictures, and she began to drive by the places where she used to live over and over. Ed was no help. Lately, he had started acting more and more like his daddy, trying to behave like he thought the man of the house should. He had become more closed off as the years went by, and on Saturdays he would wander around the Home Improvement Center alone for hours looking for something, but he didn't know what. He hunted and fished and watched his football games like the other men, but she began to suspect that he too was just playing a part. Evelyn stared into the empty ice cream carton and wondered where the smiling girl in the school pictures had gone. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, November 2, 1932. Whistle Stop Pig Club started. Due to the encouragement of the Alabama Extension Service, a local pig club has been formed. Anyone wanting information is to call Mrs. Bertha Vick at home. Bertha said that a Miss Zula Height of Kittrell, North Carolina, earned a purebred registered China pig in just 7 days. And Bertha said that you could do the same thing if you just put your mind to it. She said to own a purebred pig is a mark of distinction for you and your community and will start you on the road to prosperity. It will mean the laying of a foundation for a comfortable income for you all of your life, and when old age overtakes you. Itchy just got her brand new Philco radio at the cafe and says anybody wanting to hear Amos and Andy or any other program is welcome to come in and need not order anything to eat. She says the sound is good at night especially. By the way, does anybody know how to get rid of dog tracks in cement? If so, call me up or come by the post office and tell me. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, January 12, 1986. Evelyn opened her purse and gave Mrs. Threadgood one of the pimento cheese sandwiches she had wrapped in wax paper and brought from home. Mrs. Threadgood was delighted. "Oh, thank you. I love a good pimento cheese sandwich. In fact, I love anything to eat that's a pretty color. Don't you think pimento cheese has a pretty color? It's so cheery." I like a red pepper, too, and I used to love candied apples, but I can't eat them any more because of my teeth. Come to think of it, I like anything that's red. She thought for a minute. We had a red hen named Sister once, and every time I'd go in the backyard, I'd say, "Sister, don't you peck my toes, girl, or I'll fry you up with dumplings." And she'd cock her head and walk sideways away from me. She'd peck everybody else except me and my little boy, Albert. We never could eat that hen, even during the Depression. She died of old age. When I get to heaven with all my people, I hope Sister and Cookie the Raccoon is gonna be there. I know old Sipsy's gonna be there. I don't have any idea where Sipsy came from. You never know where colored people come from. She was about 10 or 11 when she started working for Mama Threadgood. She'd walked over from Troutville, the colored quarters across the tracks, and said her name was Sipsy Peavy and she was looking for a job, and Mama just kept her. She helped raise all the Threadgood children. Sipsy was a skinny little thing, and funny. She had all those old-timey colored superstitions. Her mother'd been a slave, and she was scared to death of spells. Told Mama that her neighbor in Troutville had put yellow conjure powder in this man's shoes every night and had caused him to lose his functions. But the thing she was the most deathly afraid of in the world was the heads of animals. If you brought her a chicken or a fish, or if Big George killed a hog, she wouldn't touch it or cook it until she buried the head out in the garden. She said that if you didn't bury the head, the spirit of that animal would enter your body and cause you to go completely insane. One time, Papa forgot and brought some hogshead cheese in the house, and Sipsy ran home screaming like a banshee and wouldn't come back until the place had been conjured by a friend of hers. She must have buried hundreds of heads out in the garden. But you know, we got the biggest tomatoes and okra and squash in town because of it. She laughed. Buddy used to call it the fish head garden. But with all of her spooky ways, there wasn't a better cook in the state of Alabama. Even at 11, they say she could make the most delicious biscuits and gravy, cobbler, fried chicken, turnip greens, and black-eyed peas. And her dumplings were so light, they would float in the air, and you'd have to catch them to eat them. All the recipes that were used at the cafe were hers. She taught Iggy and Ruth everything they knew about cooking. I don't know why Sipsy never had any children of her own. You never saw anybody love babies more than Sipsy did. All the colored women in Troutville would leave their babies with Sipsy overnight when they wanted to go out and have a good time. They knew she'd take good care of them. Sipsy said nothing made her happier than to have a little baby to rock. She'd rock those little babies and sang to them all night long, sometimes two at a time, and just pine away for one of her own. Then, one afternoon in November, right around Thanksgiving, Mama said it was freezing cold outside and all the trees were bare. Sipsy was upstairs making the beds when a friend of hers from the colored church came in the backyard hollering up to her. Her friend was all excited and told her that there was a girl from Birmingham down at the train station that was giving away a baby, and she said to hurry up 'cause the train was fixin' to leave. With that, Sipsy ran downstairs as fast as she could with nothing on but a thin dress and her apron. When she ran through the back door, Mama Threadgood said she yelled at her to put her coat on, but she called back, "I don't have time, Miss Threadgood. I got to go get me that baby," and was gone in a flash. Mama stood on the back porch and waited, and pretty soon she saw the train pull away, and here came Sipsy, grinning from ear to ear, her legs all scratched and bleeding from running through the briars, carrying the fattest, blackest little baby boy, all wrapped up in a towel that said Hotel Dixie, Memphis, Tennessee. Sipsy said that gal had been on her way back home and had told Sipsy she didn't dare show up with a baby 'cause her husband had been in jail for 3 years. So we never did know the baby's real name. Sipsy said since he came off the train, she would just call him George Pullman Peavy, after the man that invented the Pullman car. But whoever his real daddy was, he must have been a big man, because George grew up to be a 6'4", 250-pounder. When he was a little boy, Papa took him over to the store and taught him how to be a butcher. He was slaughtering hogs when he was only 10, and Sipsy was so proud of him. She couldn't have loved him any more if he had been her very own. She used to hug him, and she would say, "Honey, just 'cause we ain't no kin don't mean you don't belong to me." And later, when Big George was on trial, she dressed up and went to that courtroom, come rain or come shine. She must have been close to 90 years old. Course, you can never really tell how old colored people are. She was always singing her gospel songs, "In the Baggage Car Ahead" and "I'm Going Home on the Morning Train," always singing about trains. The night before she died, she told George that she had a dream where she saw Jesus all dressed in white. He was the conductor of a ghost train, and he was coming to get her and take her to heaven. But I would venture to say she was still cooking over at the cafe well up into her 80s. That's the reason most people came, because of her cooking. It sure wasn't for the look of the place. When Iggy and Ruth bought it, it wasn't nothing more but one big old room. It sat just across the street from the railroad tracks, down from the post office where Dot Weems worked. I remember the day they moved in the cafe. We were all down there helping, and Sipsy was busy sweeping the floor when she noticed that Ruth was hanging her picture of the Last Supper. Sipsy stopped sweeping and studied that picture for a while, and then she asked, "Miss Ruth, who's that sitting up there at the table with Mr. Jesus?" Ruth, who was trying to be sweet, said, "Why, Sipsy, that's Mr. Jesus and the brethren." Sipsy looked back at her and she said, "Oh, I thought Miss Mary just had one boy," and went on sweeping. We about died laughing. Sipsy knew exactly who that was in the picture. She just liked to play with people. Julian and Cleo had built 4 wooden booths and built the room in the back so Iggy and Ruth would have a place to live. The cafe part had walls that were knotty Georgia pine, and the floor was just plain old wood. Ruth tried to fix the place up. She put a picture of a ship sailing in the moonlight, but Iggy came right along behind her and took it down and stuck up a picture she found of a bunch of dogs sitting around a card table, smoking cigars and playing poker. And she wrote underneath it, "The Dill Pickle Club." That was the name of this crazy club that she and her friend Grady Kilgore had started. Other than the Christmas decorations they put up the first year that Iggy never did take down, and an old railroad calendar, that was it. There was only about 4 tables and a bunch of uncertain chairs. She laughed. You never knew for certain if they was gonna hold you up or not. And they never did have a cash register. They just kept the money in a Roy Tan cigar box and made your change out of that. At the counter, they had potato chips and pigskins on a rack, combs and chewing tobacco, fishing lures and little corncob pipes. Iggy opened the place at daybreak and didn't close the place until, as she said, the last dog was hung. The big L&N switching yard was only 2 blocks down the street, and all the railroad people ate there, colored and white alike. She'd serve the colored out the back door. Of course, a lot of people didn't like the idea of her selling food to the coloreds, and she got into some trouble doing it. But she said that nobody was going to tell her what she could and could not do. Cleo said she stood right up to the Ku Klux Klan all by herself and wouldn't let them stop her. As good-natured as she was, Iggy turned out to be brave when push came to shove. The Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, March 22, 1933. Iggy was drinking coffee and talking about not much of anything with her hobo friend Smokey. Back in the kitchen, Sipsy and Onzel were busy frying up a batch of green tomatoes for the lunch crowd, due in about 11:30, and listening to the Wings Over Jordan Gospel Hour over WAPI radio, when O.C. Smith knocked at the kitchen door. Sipsy came out into the cafe, wiping her hands on her apron. "Miss Iggy, they is a colored boy who's axin' to speak with you." Iggy went to the screen door and immediately recognized O.C. Smith, a friend of hers from Troutville, who worked at the railroad yard. "Well, hey there, O.C., how are you?"
"I's fine, Miss Iggy."
"What can I do for you?"
"Miss Iggy, they's a whole bunch of us boys over at the yard, and we's been smelling barbecue every day for about 2 months, and it's about to drive us out of our heads. And we's wondering if you wouldn't be willing to sell us some of them barbecue sandwiches. I've got money."
Iggy sighed and shook her head. "Let me tell you something, O.C. You know that if it was up to me, I'd have you come on in the front door and sit at a table. But you know I can't do that."
"Yes'm."
"There's a bunch in town that would burn me down in a minute, and I've got to make a living."
"Yes'm, I knows you do.
But I want you to go back over to the yard and tell your friends any time they want anything just to come on around to the kitchen door." He grinned.
"Yes'm."
"Tell Sipsy what you want, and she'll fix you up."
"Yes'm, thank you, ma'am."
"Sipsy, give him his barbecue and anything else he wants. Give him some pie, too." Sipsy mumbled under her breath. "You gonna get yourself in a whole lot of trouble with them Ku Kluxes, and I'm gonna be gone. You ain't gwine see me around no more, no ma'am."
But she fixed the sandwiches and got grape drinks and pie and put them in a paper sack with a napkin for him. About 3 days later, Grady Kilgore, the local sheriff and part-time railroad detective, came in all puffed up. He was a big bear of a man who had been a friend of her brother Buddy. He put his hat on the hat rack like he always did and told Iggy he had some serious business to discuss. She brought his coffee to the booth and sat down. Grady leaned across the table and started his unpleasant task.
"Now, Iggy, you ought not to be selling those niggers food. You know better than that. And there's some boys in this town that's not too happy about it. Nobody wants to eat in the same place that niggers come. It's not right, and you just ought not be doing it."
Iggy thought it over for a moment and shook her head in agreement. "You're right, Grady. I know better, and I just ought not be doing it." Grady sat back and seemed pleased. She continued, "Yeah, Grady, it's funny how people do things they ought not to do. Take yourself, for instance. I guess a lot of people might think that after church on Sunday you ought not to go over to the river and see Eva Bates. I reckon Gladys might think you ought not be doing that." Grady, who was at the present time a deacon in the Baptist church and had married the former Gladys Moats, who was known to have a temper, got flustered.
"Oh, come on, Iggy, that's not funny."
"I think it is. Just like I think a bunch of grown men getting liquored up and putting sheets on their heads is pretty damn funny." Grady called out to Ruth, who was behind the counter. "Ruth, will you come over here and try to talk some sense into her?
She ain't gonna listen to me. I'm just trying to keep her out of trouble, that's all. Now, I'm not saying who, but there are some people in town that don't like her selling to niggers.
Iggy lit her camel and smiled.
Well, Grady, tell you what. The next time those some people come in here, like Jack Butts and Wilbur Weems and Pete Tidwell, I'll ask them if they don't want anybody to know who they are when they go marching around in one of those stupid parades you boys have. Why don't they have enough sense to change their shoes? Now, wait a minute, Iggy. Oh, hell, Grady. Y'all ain't fooling anybody. Why, I'd recognize those size 14 clodhoppers you got on anywhere.
Grady looked down at his feet. He was losing this battle in a hurry.
Oh, now, Iggy, I've got to tell them something. Are you gonna stop or not? Ruth, come over here and help me with this stubborn mule.
Ruth went to the table.
Oh, Grady, what harm can it be to sell a few sandwiches out the back door? It's not like they're coming in and sitting down.
Well, I don't know, Ruth. I'll have to talk to the boys.
They're not hurting anybody, Grady.
He thought for a minute.
Well, okay for now, I guess.
He pointed his finger at Iggy.
But you make sure you keep them at the back door, you hear me?
He got up to leave and put his hat on and then turned back to Iggy.
We still playing poker Friday?
Yep. 8 o'clock.
And bring plenty of money. I feel lucky. I'll tell Jack and them. Bye, Ruth.
Bye, Grady.
Iggy shook her head as she watched him go on down the street.
Ruth, I wish you could have seen that big ox down at the river for 3 days, drunk as a dog, crying like a baby, 'cause Joe, that old colored man that raised him, died. I swear, I don't know what people are using for brains anymore. Imagine those boys. They're terrified to sit next to a nigger and have a meal, but they'll eat eggs that came right out of a chicken's ass.
Oh, Iggy.
Iggy laughed.
I'm sorry, but it just makes me mad sometimes.
I know, honey. But you shouldn't get yourself so upset. That's just the way people are. And there's not a thing in the world you can do to change them. That's just how it is.
Iggy smiled at her and wondered what would happen if she didn't have Ruth to let off steam with. Ruth smiled back.
They both knew they had to make a decision about what to do, and they did. After that day, the only thing that changed was on the menu that hung on the back door. Everything was a nickel or a dime cheaper. They figured fair was fair.
The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, April 6, 1933. Change of menu at cafe. Patrons of the cafe got quite a surprise when they read the menu last week that featured, among other things, filet of possum, prime rib of polecat, goat's liver and onions, bullfrog pudding, and turkey buzzard pie a la mode. An unsuspecting couple who had come all the way from Gate City for dinner read the menu and were halfway down the block when Iggy opened the door and yelled April Fools at them. The couple from Gate City then ordered from the regular menu and got some free coconut cream pie. By the way, my other half let one of his old hunting dogs in the house the other day, and he brought this bone with him, and wouldn't you know it, I tripped on it and broke my toe. Dr. Hadley wrapped it up for me, but I'm having to wear house shoes to work and can't get out and gather news like I want to. So if you have any news, just bring it on over to me at the post office. Dot Weems. 212 Rhodes Circle, Birmingham, Alabama, January 19, 1986. It was Sunday again. Evelyn and Ed Couch were getting ready to leave for the nursing home. She turned off the coffee pot and wished that she didn't have to go. But Ed was so sensitive where his mother was concerned that she dare not refuse to go, and at least say hello to her whiny, demanding mother-in-law. Going out there was like torture to her. She hated the smell of sickness and Lysol and death. It reminded her of her mother, of doctors and hospitals. Evelyn had been 40 when her mother died, and after that, the fear started. Now, when she read the morning paper, she turned immediately to the obituary column, even before she read her horoscope. She was always pleased when the person who had died had been in their 70s or 80s, and she loved it when the dear departed had been over 90. It made her feel safe somehow. But when she read that they had died in their 40s or 50s, it disturbed her all day, especially if at the end of the obituary the family had requested that a donation be sent to the Cancer Society. But what disturbed her the most was when the cause of death was not listed. A short illness of what? Died suddenly of what? What kind of accident? She wanted all the details in black and white, no guessing. And she loathed it when the family asked that a donation be made to the Humane Society. What did that mean? Rabies? Dog bite? Cat fever? But lately it had been mostly donations to the Cancer Society. She wondered why she had to live in a body that would get old and break down and feel pain. Why couldn't she have been living inside a desk, a big sturdy desk, or a stove, or a washing machine? She would much rather have an ordinary repairman, like an electrician or a plumber, than a doctor work on her. While she had been in the throes of labor pains, Dr. Clyde, her obstetrician, had stood there and lied to her face. "Mrs. Couch, you're going to forget these pains as soon as you see that baby of yours. So push a little harder. You won't even remember this. Trust me." Wrong. She remembered every pain right down the line and would not have had the second child if Ed had not insisted on trying for a boy. Another lie exposed. The second one hurt as much as the first, maybe even more, because this time she knew what to expect. She was mad at Ed the whole 9 months. And thank God she had Tommy, because this was it as far as she was concerned. Her whole life she'd been afraid of doctors. Then wary, but now she hated, loathed, and despised them. Ever since that doctor had come swaggering into her mother's hospital room with his chart that day, this little tin god in a polyester suit and the 3-pound shoes, so smug, so self-important, with the nurses fluttering around him like geisha girls. He had not even been her mother's doctor. He was only making some other doctor's rounds that morning. Evelyn had been standing there holding her mother's hand. When he came in, he did not bother to introduce himself. She said, "Hello, doctor, I'm her daughter, Evelyn Couch." Without taking his eyes off the chart, he said in a loud voice, "Your mother has a rapidly progressing cancer of the lung that has metastasized itself in the liver, pancreas, and spleen, with some indication of invasion into the bone marrow." Up until that very moment, her mother had not even known that she had cancer. Evelyn had not wanted her to know because her mother had been so scared. She would remember the look of sheer terror on her mother's face as long as she lived. And that doctor, who continued on down the hall with his entourage. 2 days later, her mother went into a coma. She could also never forget that gray, sterile, concrete-walled intensive care waiting room where she had spent all those weeks, frightened and confused, just like the rest of the ones waiting there. Knowing that their loved one was lying just down the hall in a cold, sunless room, waiting to die. Here they were, perfect strangers in this small space, sharing what was probably the most intimate and painful moment of their lives, not knowing how to act or what to say. There were no rules of etiquette. Nobody had prepared them for this ordeal. Poor people, terrified like herself, trying to be brave, chatting on about their everyday lives, completely in shock, pretending everything was all right. One family had been so frightened that they couldn't bring themselves to accept the fact that the woman down the hall dying was their mother. They would always refer to her as their patient and ask Evelyn how her patient was doing, to put the truth as far away from them as possible and try to ease the pain. Every day they waited together, knowing the moment would come, that awful moment when they would be called upon to make the decision whether or not to turn the machines off. It's for the best. They'll be much better off. It's what they would want. The doctor says they're already gone. This is only a technicality. A technicality? All those calm adult discussions, when all she really wanted to do was scream for her mama, her sweet mama, the one person in the world who loved her better than anyone ever would or ever could. That Saturday, the doctor came to the waiting room and looked in. All eyes were on him, and the conversation stopped. He glanced around the room. "Mrs. Couch, may I see you in my office for a moment, please?" As she gathered her purse with shaky hands and pounding heart, the others looked at her in sympathy, and one woman touched her arm. But they were secretly relieved that it had not been them. She felt as if she were in a dream and listened carefully to what he said. He made it seem so simple and so natural. No point in prolonging it. He made perfect sense. She got up like a zombie and went home. She thought she was ready to accept it, to let her go. But then nobody was ever really ready to turn off their mother's machine, no matter what they thought. To turn off the light of their childhood and walk away, just as if they were turning out a light and leaving a room. She could never forgive herself for not having the courage to go back over to the hospital and be with her mother. She still woke up crying over the guilt, and there was not a way in the world she could ever make up for it. Maybe having gone through this had been the start of Evelyn's fear of anything having to do with doctors or hospitals. She didn't know. All she knew was that the thought of going to a doctor made her literally break out in a cold sweat and start to shake all over. And just the sound of the word cancer caused the hair on the back of her arms to stand up. She had stopped touching her breasts at all anymore, because one time she had felt a lump and almost fainted. Fortunately, it turned out to be Kleenex that had stuck to her bra in the wash. She knew it was an unreasonable fear and that she really should go in for a checkup. They say you should have one every year. She knew she should do it, if not for her sake, for her children's sake. She knew all that, but it didn't make any difference. She'd had a few moments of bravery and made appointments for a checkup, but she always canceled them at the last minute. The last time she had been to a doctor was 6 years ago for a bladder infection. All she wanted was for the doctor to prescribe some antibiotics over the phone, but he made her come in and insisted on giving her a pelvic exam. Lying there with her feet in the stirrups, she wondered if there was anything worse than having some man you didn't know reach inside of you looking for things like you were a grab bag. The doctor asked how long it had been since her last breast exam. Evelyn lied and said, 3 months ago. He said, Well, as long as you're here, I might as well do another one. She started talking a mile a minute to try and distract him, but in the middle of it he said, Uh-oh, I don't like the feel of this. The days of waiting for the test results had been almost unbearable. She'd walked around in a nightmarish fog, praying and bargaining with a God she was not even sure she believed in. She promised if he would only let her not have cancer, she would never complain about anything again. She would spend the rest of her life just being happy to be alive, doing good works for the poor, and going to church every day. But the day after she found out she was fine and would not be dead soon, as she had imagined, she went back to being just like she was. Only now, after that scare, she was convinced that every pain was cancer, and if she went to the doctor to see if it was, she was sure that not only would it be true, but that he would listen with a stethoscope to her heart and rush her to the hospital for open-heart surgery before she could escape. She began living with one foot in the grave. When she looked at her palm, she even imagined that her lifeline was getting shorter. She knew she couldn't go through any more days of waiting for test results, and decided that she really did not want to know if anything was wrong, and preferred to drop dead in her tracks, never knowing. This morning, as they drove out to the nursing home, she realized that her life was becoming unbearable. Every morning she would play games with herself just to get her through the day, like telling herself that today something wonderful was going to happen, that the next time the phone would ring, it would be good news that would change her life, or that she was going to get a surprise in the mail. But it was never anything but junk mail, a wrong number, a neighbor wanting something. The quiet hysteria and awful despair had started when she finally began to realize that nothing was ever going to change, that nobody would be coming for her to take her away. She began to feel as if she were at the bottom of a well, screaming, no one to hear. Lately it had been an endless procession of long black nights and gray mornings, when her sense of failure swept over her like a 500-pound wave, and she was scared. But it wasn't death that she feared. She had looked down into that black pit of death and had wanted to jump in once too often. As a matter of fact, the thought began to appeal to her more and more. She even knew how she would kill herself. It would be with a silver bullet, as round and as smooth as an ice-cold blue martini. She would place the gun in the freezer for a few hours before she did it, so it would feel frosty and cold against her head. She could almost feel the ice-cold bullet shooting through her hot, troubled brain, freezing the pain for good. The sound of the gun blast would be the last sound she would ever hear. And then, nothing. Maybe just the silent sound that a bird might hear, flying in the clean, cool air, high above the earth. The sweet, pure air of freedom. No, it wasn't death she was afraid of. It was this life of hers that was beginning to remind her of that gray, intensive care waiting room. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, May 16, 1934. Gopher Bite Report. Bertha Vick reported that Friday night, at about 2 a.m. in the morning, she went to the bathroom and was bitten by a gopher rat that had come up through the pipes and into her toilet. She said she ran and woke up Harold, who did not believe her, but he went in and looked, and sure enough, there it was, swimming around in the toilet. My other half said that the floods must have been the reason it came up through the pipes. Bertha said she did not care what caused it, that she would always be sure to look before she sat down anywhere. Harold is having the gopher rat stuffed. Was anybody else's light bill high this month? Mine was very high, which I think is strange. But my other half was off for a week, fishing with his brother Alton, and he is the one who always leaves the lights on. Let me know. By the way, Essie Rue has a job over in Birmingham playing the Protective Life organ for the Protective Life Insurance Company radio show on WAPI. So be sure and listen. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, January 19, 1986. Mrs. Threadgood guessed that Evelyn hadn't come out to the nursing home that Sunday, and she was taking a walk on the side corridor where they keep the walkers and the wheelchairs. As she turned the corner, there was Evelyn sitting all by herself in one of the wheelchairs, eating a Baby Ruth candy bar with big tears streaming down her face. Mrs. Threadgood went over to her. "Honey, what in the world is the matter?" Evelyn glanced up at Mrs. Threadgood and said, "I don't know," and continued to cry and eat her candy. "Come on, honey, get your purse. Let's walk a little." Mrs. Threadgood took her hand and pulled her up from the chair and began to walk her up the corridor and back. "Now tell me, honey, what is it? What's the matter? What are you so sad over?" Evelyn said, "I don't know," and burst into tears all over again. "Oh, sugar, things can't be all that bad. Let's start one by one, and you tell me some of the things that are bothering you."
"Well, it just seems like since my children went off to college, I just feel useless."
Mrs. Threadgood said, "That's perfectly understandable, honey. Everybody goes through that." Evelyn continued,
And I just can't seem to stop eating. I've tried and tried. Every day I wake up and think that today I'm gonna stay on my diet. And every day I go off. I hide candy bars all over the house and in the garage. I don't know what's the matter with me."
Mrs. Threadgood said, "Well, honey, a candy bar's not gonna hurt you." Evelyn said,
"One's all right, not six or eight. I just wish I had the guts to get really fat and be done with it, or to have the willpower to lose weight and be really thin. I just feel stuck right in the middle. Women's lib came too late for me. I was already married with two children when I found out that I didn't have to get married. I thought you had to. What did I know? And now it's too late to change. I feel like life has just passed me by."
Then she turned to Mrs. Threadgood, tears still running down her face.
"Oh, Mrs. Threadgood, I'm too young to be old and too old to be young. I just don't fit anywhere. I wish I could kill myself, but I don't have the courage."
Mrs. Threadgood was appalled. "Why, Evelyn Couch, you mustn't even think such a thing. That's like sticking a sword in the side of Jesus. That's just silly talk, honey. You just got to pull yourself together and open your heart to the Lord. He'll help you. Now, let me ask you this. Are your breasts sore?
Evelyn looked at her.
Well, sometimes.
Does your back and legs ache?
Yes. How did you know?
Simple, honey. You're just going through a bad case of menopause. That's all that's the matter with you.